Kid, honestly, I could pod on and on. I could explain every podcast phenomenon. The pod, the cast, the ground, all that was podcasting around. I pod a cast, I podcast its guts. Sprouted a pod, now you got cast of nuts. Pod's the lesson, podcast the takeaway. Pod mess with casty podcast on my castaway. And the pod a cast pod of my cast is podcast pod the castries podcast. Pod where I've cast, I made everything podcast. Podcast pod 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 podcast cast cast podcast pod podcast. Pod 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 cast!
Good one.
That literally, the whole stupid singing a song with podcast bit was because one day while we were thinking about doing this, I think it was while I was working on the I, Coleman is Doomed finale where I also did a parody of You're Welcome.
Yeah.
And so I was like trying to put new lyrics to it and I started going, pod's the podcast, pod is the castaway. So it's all been building up to that. Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Well, I actually have something else for you.
Oh?
I am a guy who watches movies and a guy who loves my mom.
Aww.
She calls me on Discord when we're doing a podcast. I'm a survivor of the fox and hound. I am descended from super nerds who spend too much time watching crap from Disney. And we watch all of the wartime shorts. And we watch Dinosaur. And we learned about some awful guys like Katzenberg. And despite all the dead status moms and the bad dads and the spin-offs, sequels, remakes, and reboots, all the movies and light butter slipped out of our heads. We did our best, and this is the end. It is the podcast.
I love it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Me, Mom, and the Mouse, a podcast about the joy of watching cartoons with your family. We're watching every film in the Disney animated canon and talking about how it was made, what it means, and why we love it or don't. And this is the last time we are doing that. My name is Isaac Coleman, and I am joined for the last time ever. We will never talk after this.
Oh, no.
As I've said in the past. So enjoy it while it lasts. By my mother, Rue Coleman.
Hello, for the last time.
And we want to give a special shout out to our editor, Brad Murray at Oak Studios. Thanks for all the work that you do, you shapeshifter, you demigod of the wind and sea, and you hero of men. Don't forget, hero of men.
Hero to all.
This week on the program, we have finished the revival era. We're done. This is the last one, as we count it, with 2016's Moana, directed by, okay, let's see if I can get the first names right. This is my last chance. Tony Musker and Billy Bob Clements.
Your last chance to goof them off.
That would be Ron Clements and John Musker, co-directed by Chris Williams and Don Hall of Big Hero 6. Mom, we're here. We're at the end.
Yep, I know. Pretty crazy.
Pretty weird. Do you want to talk a little bit, not only about what this movie means to you, but why we picked this as the end point for our podcast? When the people, they clamor for more, Mom. There's so many more movies, like Encanto and some other ones.
And they keep making more, too, you know.
They can't be stopped.
Very true. As this podcast has proved, since it doesn't matter how deep into the depths they go, they come back. We went and saw this movie. Pretty sure it was its opening weekend, right? You and I went to see it while Isaiah was having his birthday party, right?
That's correct. You and I went and saw this, just the two of us.
Yeah, because Isaiah was having a big party. I'm pretty sure he was doing some games and your dad was helping host or something.
That's correct.
So it was just you and me, and we were like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, let's go see Moana.
It was a true Me, Mom, and the Mouse experience.
Indeed. And I loved this movie from the first time I saw it. The music is great. The story's great. The music always makes me want to like choke up a couple times. It is my favorite of the revival era. I just can't help it. I love it so much. We decided to stop with this one partially because it was really, it's one of the few, if the only one in this whole Disney animated canon that you and I saw just the two of us.
Yeah, definitely. For the first time.
And when we were first talking about this, of course, the movies that come after this, you got Ralph Breaks the Internet, you got Frozen 2, and it's like, what, it's going to be all sequels? That's boring to talk about.
Right. At the time, those were the only ones. And
right.
So we were like, we don't really want to talk about those. And also, we don't want to end the podcast because we are going to end the podcast, folks. We can't keep this up forever. We can't keep pace with Disney, and we're not even really interested in doing so. You know, as I alluded to with my last show, I, Coleman is Doomed, I like things that end. I like things that have good endings, even though that is now anathema to the entire Disney production model.
Yeah, but Moana is a great ending for us because it's a great movie. We had a great experience seeing it, and none of the later movies are going to be like that.
And I do think, I mean, it's a little hard to say where we cut the revival era, and I'm sure it's something people will debate forever, much like where does the Renaissance stop and start. But this is the last John Lasseter movie, technically, because he leaves in November 2017, and Jennifer Lee steps up, and the next one, Ralph Breaks the Internet, comes out in 2018. I suspect, you know, the transition in leadership is part of the reason that they had that gap year.
Yeah.
You know, and as we say, like these other things, you know, you've got two sequels, then we've got Raya, then we've got Encanto. These movies, there is no identity to the Jennifer Lee era yet. This isn't a criticism of her. It's just, it's more interesting to talk about things that have passed and that we can reflect on.
Yeah, and Moana being 6 years ago now, you know, nearly five and a half, where there's at least some history, you're able to like think back on it. How is it standing up over a few years rather than, you know, Encanto came out last year, super popular, but how's it going to last? We have no idea.
Exactly. Because, you know, talking about what this movie means to us. When I first saw Moana, I liked it, but I didn't love it. One of the few years up to that point that had two Disney animated features come out, Zootopia was the critical darling. It was the one that felt like it was important and of the moment.
Uh-huh.
And Moana just kind of felt like it's another Disney princess movie. It's cool that it's such a different culture, but at the end of the day, it's a Disney princess movie. You know, we've seen this before. And over time, my opinion has flipped. And I think maybe this is ego, but I do think that kind of the critical consensus has flipped, where this movie is quite well liked in certain circles, definitely even loved. Whereas Zootopia now, it was so of the moment, as we discussed last week, that it didn't leave that moment. It's kind of frozen in amber. Whereas this is a timeless story and a very lovely movie and a movie that grows on you as you watch it more. I definitely, to be clear, still liked it the first time. But, you know, when we were talking about it afterwards and like in the ongoing weeks, you were like, I think this is a great movie. I think this is, you know, maybe one of the best. And I was like, really? I quite liked it, but I don't know if I see that. And I've come around more to your way of thinking for sure.
Yeah.
It's a really enjoyable film.
Indeed.
After directing Princess and the Frog, which was a mild success, despite being released the weekend of Avatar, Musgrave Clements started working on a new project, which was an adaptation of Mort by Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
I think it would be a cool animated movie. I don't really want to see the Disney-fied version of that.
I get that. I just want to see a cool, you know, animated Mort.
Sure. Big Discworld fans here. You know who else didn't want to see a Disney-fied version of Mort? Was Disney. Disney was very nervous about the idea in general. An awful lot of death, an awful lot of kind of subversive themes and so on. Pixar, every Pixar movie can be about death. You can go kill some main characters for Pixar, but not for Disney. Parents only. main characters, no.
Well, if they die, they have to come back.
But there was a film rights issue, which is that for whatever reason, they were not allowed to simply buy the rights to adapt Mort. They would have had to buy the rights to adapt the entire 40-something book Discworld series. And Disney was certainly not going to shell out to do that for a book they were not that interested in the first place. And Musker and Clement spent about 2 years on this, which is not necessarily uncommon. You know, you need to put together a pitch for the rights holders, you know, some storyboards, some here's our take on the material and so on. You know, they were disheartened by this. So they pitched three original ideas because, of course, as we know, John Lasseter doesn't want you to pitch just one movie ever.
Ever again. It's just always, give me your top five, six,
right,
seven. Let's have them all.
It's the kinder, gentler Gong Show, essentially.
Yeah.
Obviously, the one that got greenlit was a story of Polynesian mythology, specifically based on the demigod Maui. Musker had recently started reading about this, and he thought it would be an interesting subject for an animated film. I mean, why not? We've adapted German folklore and French folklore and recently, you know, Scandinavian folklore. Well, I guess actually that hadn't happened yet, but you know what I mean. And why not some Polynesian folklore?
Yeah.
And they started taking several research trips to the South Pacific and began kind of putting some story elements together. The two biggest elements of the story that were pretty much there from the beginning was the idea of Taka and Tafiti, who are based on an actual story of Maui from Maori mythology, where the life goddess Hine Titama, I think is how you say that. We have a dumb white people mispronouncing things warning for the whole episode.
Yeah.
But the life goddess Hine Titama became the death goddess Hine Nui Te Po, which they shortened and later just changed outright to make it a little more palatable to American mouths. Now, in the actual story, Maui attempts to defeat the death goddess to bring immortality to humans, which is somewhat similar to the movie. And he fails, which is definitely similar to the movie. And he is killed, which, of course, does not happen in the movie because, again, no protagonist murder.
Yep.
And the other idea they had was to do something with the not voyaging anymore, because this is a real thing that happened. For anyone that doesn't know, it's very interesting.
The Great Pause.
The Great Pause, yes. It's very interesting history. The Polynesian peoples were incredible sailors. I mean, they were so technologically advanced in the art of sailing, despite having relatively simple ships in some regards.
Yep.
They were able to sail so much farther. I believe they were the first people to circumnavigate the globe. You know, it's this really amazing stuff. And then for some reason, they stopped doing that for
about 1,000 years.
Yeah, about 1,000 years. Nobody's entirely sure why. There are various theories. You know, this was not a history-keeping people, per se, more of an oral tradition, so it's not known exactly why. But then about 1,000 years later, they start voyaging again. So Musker and Clements were like, what if this is because of magic?
Yeah.
I think very famously, the first draft of this script was written by Taika Waititi.
Yeah, but he claims that pretty much all that remained of his original script was exterior, ocean, day. That's it.
Yes, indeed. He didn't really have anything to do with the finished product, but he was involved, which is sort of interesting because he hadn't really had, I mean, I guess there was Flight of the Conchords, of course, that he and Jemaine Clement had initially, but he hadn't had his big American breakout successes initially, What We Do in the Shadows, which of course leads to Thor Ragnarok and so on. A lot of people involved in this movie who became famous during production of this movie.
Very true. Kind of a weird situation.
They also very famously had the Oceanic Story Trust.
Yep, they got several people from all of the islands they visited, like Samoa, Tahiti, Fiji, and had them basically make sure that they were being respectful with the story they were writing and trying to tell. They wanted to make it both Disney and as authentic as possible. Do you know what I mean? Like, authentically a Disney movie set in this world.
Basically, I think they didn't want to offend anyone. Yep. Or want to offend as few people as possible.
Yeah.
Which, considering some of the crap they've pulled in the other episodes that we've done, yeah, go for it. And so whenever we talk about a movie that relates to a culture that is not our own, we share some links to writings from people who are in that culture in the description, and this time is no different. It should be said that, broadly speaking, the Pacific Islander and Polynesian communities really seem to like this movie. They seem to be happy with it. I think it's clear that it doesn't have any of the glaring issues of your Pocahontases, your, you know, heaven forbid, your Peter Pans, your Dumbos, even perhaps your Princesses and the Frogses, plural. And so if you look up anything about, you know, what do Polynesian people, although it should be known, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of different Polynesian peoples. But broadly speaking, if you look up, you know, what people thought of this movie, it was quite positive. And Disney did even release this movie in several native Polynesian languages, Maori and the Hawaiian language
and Tahitian,
although some of those didn't actually get properly released on home video, which, yeah, kind of feels like you could have just put another audio track on the disc, but okay, Disney. At any rate, you know, if you look up stuff about this, you'll find, I mean, the top result is like this BuzzFeed article that collects a whole bunch of tweets of people saying, like, I really liked the movie. I thought we could do better than BuzzFeed tweet aggregations, though, for our links. Hold ourselves to a slightly higher standard. So the three articles I have for you, the first one is from Vicente Diaz. He is, I believe, Pohnpeian and Filipino. He comes from the Micronesian island of Guam. He is an associate professor in Native Studies and American Indian Studies. His article is called Don't Swallow or Be Swallowed by Disney's Culturally Authenticated Moana, those last three words being in quotes. I saw this referenced in several places as kind of being the leading dissenting opinion, although it's actually no longer available online now, so I linked to an archive.org, well, an archive, a saved older version of the website.
Yeah.
And to be honest, he is talking less about the movie itself and more essentially saying, just because Disney has made this one movie that is potentially pretty good, don't forget, you know, what Disney represents. Don't forget that they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart, and that native, you know, liberation isn't really going to be possible until big corporations like this, and even, you know, this big corporation very specifically, no longer exist. You know, that's why it's like, don't swallow or be swallowed by, right? He's not even really saying don't enjoy the movie, just like, don't be like, oh, Disney made one movie that's okay, thus they have atoned for all of their racism, both in their past movies and in, say, their active efforts to donate heavily to Republican politicians and, you know, all kinds of extremely questionable causes. He also references another author who I linked to in our second link, which is Tina Ngata, who is Maori. She is also a teacher at New Zealand's largest indigenous university, alongside many other things that she does. And the article, to be honest, it's really a video interview, but there's a little bit of text around it. What I'm linking to with her is, despite claims of authenticity, Disney's Moana still offensive. The main thing that she talks about, which is one thing that I remember a lot of people talking about at the time, is rightly pointing out that this movie was still directed by white people, still written by white people. It's still extremely Disney-fied. It is not an authentic movie. And this is one thing that Diaz talked about as well, is like, this movie, because of the Disney Corporation's power, their influence, their reach, this is going to be Polynesian culture to so many people, right? This will be their first big introduction to it. This is certainly the first time I had ever heard of Maui. I'm sure your first time as well. And no. It's, you know, no, not yours. Okay. Well, it was my first time, and it's not a completely authentic portrayal. She talks a little bit more about some of the reasons that is. And then finally, I have sort of a dissenting opinion that actually cites both of the other sources I have linked to. It is called Beyond Paradise, Retelling Pacific Stories and Disney's Moana by Amarata Katakiri Tamera and Dione Fanotti. And this is acknowledging the previous criticisms, but talking about, like, but we shouldn't ignore how this movie was made, the contributions of the Oceanic Story Trust, all the things that are good about the movie itself, like the way that it is way less patriarchal than other Disney movies. You know, Moana is a very strong character. She saves herself.
Yep.
All of these, you know, it basically lays out all of the good things about it. So, as always, I highly encourage that people read those things.
It's another step in the right direction without being the whole 100% good thing.
I think that's about right. So one of the things that makes this movie so great, best things about this movie easily is the music.
Oh, indeed. They got to do the music, Lin-Manuel Miranda, as of course everybody knows, since it was, you know, one of the most advertised things about this movie. But they also got Opetaia Fawai, who of course is from the islands, and Mark Mancina to be the composer of the score. But the three of them really worked closely together on the music. And they actually, you know, once they'd hired all three of them, they sent them off to the islands as well to be like, you guys go have a research trip to the islands and see how you get inspired to do the music.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, this is his first contribution to Disney, which had always kind of been a dream of his because he got into music and composing after seeing The Little Mermaid. Like, as a kid, that was the thing that made him want to be a musician. He was very inspired by Howard Ashman. And so he had always been trying to get into Disney. But of course, when they started working on this film, you know, he'd had In the Heights, which was it wasn't a super well-known musical, but it did all right. All things considered, was a Broadway production, but he was not yet what he was going to be prior to this film's release because he was working simultaneously on a little musical called Hamilton, which premiered in 2015, and suddenly he is one of the most famous people in America.
Very true.
I think it's very notable that by the time this movie was coming out, all of the advertising was about Lin-Manuel Miranda, was about the song that he sings. I thought that the character in that scene, you know, the flashbacky scene, was going to be like a main character in the movie because I felt like we saw him so much. And of course, because he loves Disney so much, he has continued to be a Disney guy since, contributing to the Mary Poppins sequel, which I really dislike. And of course, the movie Encanto, which, you know, it's good.
I like Encanto.
I do like Encanto, and I definitely like its music, and I appreciate that it has a villain song that everyone loves, even though it doesn't have a villain, which I hope will inspire them to, you know, let's do something about this. Mark Mancina, I mean, he is the guy they bring in to compose score around a big songwriter.
Yeah.
Because he'd also done Tarzan and Brother Bear before this. Speaking of movies that not exactly respectful of native cultures.
Indeed. This one's a lot better, though. But, you know, for a change, he's actually working with someone from that culture to do the music as opposed to Phil Collins.
Right, that too. They went through many, many, many different versions of the script and the story. Some of that was their own desire to get the story right. Some of that was big changes they had to make because of the Oceanic Story Trust.
One of the most famous ones, of course, being that Maui was originally going to be bald. And they were like, no, Maui has a lot of hair. His hair is like his glory, his strength, his power. You can't have him be bald. He's got to have hair. And they were like, okay, how's this? No, more hair. More hair. All the hair. And the animators are like crying.
Right, because as we've discussed, hair is really hard to animate. Wet hair, 1,000 times more so. But it's extremely important for the culture that he have hair. Anyway, to help Musker and Clements both finish their story and meet their 2016 release date, because the release dates are super aggressive at this time, they brought on Don Hall and Chris Williams, who had just finished directing Big Hero 6. We talk about them both a lot in that episode. My suspicion is that I think the directors probably directed different scenes since this is such an episodic movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact Chris Williams was the one who directed and came up with the idea for the Kakamora scene because he is the action man. He loves Mad Max Fury Road and he wanted to do a Mad Max Fury Road scene. And so he did.
Kind of an odd thing to have in a Disney movie, but I love it just the same.
It's a very weird thing in the mix, but I mean, he does direct the heck out of it.
I'm not really bothered by the episodic storytelling in this movie because that feels like how myths and legends just are sometimes, you know?
Definitely. And I, you know, I really like episodic storytelling. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I mean, one of my favorite genres of movie, and my very favorite movie is a road movie, which, you know, obviously those things tend to be you're driving along, stopping at different places, and a weird episode happens, and then you move on.
They, of course, you know, develop some new technologies for the animation for this, the main ones being for the ocean, of course, and they did more work on the hair so that it's even more advanced than it was in Tangled. And it really looks amazingly realistic. Even the wet hair looks a lot better than it did. But one of the fun things they did is they actually brought back veteran animator Eric Goldberg to do the hand-drawn animation of the mini Maui on Maui's tattoos.
Yes, of course. One of my favorite things in the whole movie and something they've been talking about doing for like the entire revival era and even the experimental era, which is putting 2D animation on 3D objects.
Yeah.
They finally do that. And Eric Goldberg, for anyone who doesn't know, you know, one of the great hand-drawn animators of Disney.
Yeah, we talked about him a lot on our Fantasia 2000 episode because he was the one who was doing the Rhapsody in Blue segment.
Yes, and he directed those Staying at Home with Goofy shorts, How to Stay at Home with Goofy shorts, rather, which he just basically animated from home during the pandemic. And they're some of the best Goofy shorts to come out in years and years. He's great.
They are pretty funny.
And the movie did quite well. It was in that Frozen Big Hero 6 Zootopia range. I mean, not quite as much as Frozen, but just nothing has ever done that. And it was very critically well liked. You know, we've talked about some of the concerns that were had with it. We also didn't mention some of the scandals around it. Stupid stuff Disney did, like that Maui Halloween costume.
Yeah, that looked like skin.
Yeah, it's put your white kid in brown skin. Really a just terrible idea. Why don't you tell us about the cast?
One of the main interesting things about this cast is they actually, all of the people who do voices in the cast, except for one, are all from the Polynesian Islands. So most of them are from New Zealand or Hawaii or Samoa. Or at least of descent from those nations, except for Alan Tudyk, the only white guy doing a voice. But we'll start with Auli'i Cravalho as Moana. This was her first movie, of course. She, you know, they interviewed, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of girls to do Moana. And she was the last one they saw and, you know, the one they loved the most. The funny thing about her is that she's actually the first person to voice a Disney princess who's actually younger than her character because she was hired when she was 14 and Moana's supposed to be 16.
Yep. And can we please get her in a second good movie or what? Because after this, she's basically been stuck in Netflix original land. There was a movie she was in that came out this year called Crush, which I heard was just terrible. Didn't see it myself. But I mean, come on, she's really good in this. And I remember being really impressed with her at the time, like all the interviews and stuff she was doing. I remember there was a red carpet moment where a bunch of the people interviewing, you know, a bunch of the paparazzi essentially like couldn't pronounce her name correctly or were just calling her Moana. And she was like, no, my name is Auli'i Cravalho. I'm not Moana. That's the character. And just shutting them down. And that's how I know how to say her name. But she's a great presence. And again, get her out of the direct to streaming nightmare world and into a real movie, please.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson is Maui. I know he doesn't go by The Rock anymore, but you just have to say his name as that whole thing. It just doesn't sound right otherwise.
If you smell what The Rock is cooking, bow, 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 bow,
bow. Yes, of course, you know, he was originally a wrestler and then he, you know, decided he wanted to get into movies, as several of them do, you know, instead of the physical acting, you know,
right, yes,
of the fighting acting, it's into the movie acting. But his one of his first movies that he was in that I saw him in too was The Mummy Returns, as the worst CGI monster I've probably ever seen. Pretty up there anyway.
It's, yeah.
As the Scorpion King.
Way up there. Oof.
Mm-hmm. And of course, was in a lot of the Fast and Furious movies from Fast 5 on through like what, 8?
5 through 8, yes.
Yep, yep. And, you know, now he's doing, you know, the Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle stuff and the Jungle Cruise movie for Disney. And he'll be in that upcoming Black Adam movie for DC Universe.
He's interesting because he's very much a brand. He's one of those actors who doesn't really let you into his inner life, whether or not such a thing truly exists, to be honest. And one thing that he's been, you know, very, very clear about is like what a Dwayne Johnson movie is. And, you know, a Dwayne Johnson movie is a family film. It's a comedy. He's basically going to play the same character, which is the coolest, toughest guy ever. But he has a sense of humor about himself. His, you know, alcohol brand, I think it's a tequila brand, will feature in the movie at some point. And he's done a lot of movies like that, which honestly, like most of them are pretty good. It's like any other brand, you know.
It's a nice, fun brand, actually, you know. I kind of like an action star who can laugh at themselves.
It's, you know, it's a bit like McDonald's. You're going to get the same thing every time, but you're going to be pretty happy with it. So, you know, Skyscraper, San Andreas, Rampage, the Jumanji movies, the upcoming Black Adam, kind of all the same movie to me. Definitely Hobbs and Shaw. And of course, famously, the reason he's not in the Fast and Furious movies anymore is because he had a big falling out with Vin Diesel. But I do think that he is a really good actor, especially when he lets himself get out of the Dwayne Johnson movie. You know, I love him in a movie called Southland Tales. This was one of his first movies. It's from the writer-director of Donnie Darko. It's a really weird, artsy movie, but he is amazing in it. But that movie was critically savaged. It was booed out of Cannes. It was a massive financial disaster. And I truly think my you know, tinfoil hat theory is that that really scared him out of doing anything that challenging and weird ever again.
Yeah.
The other thing I have to say about him is that he will be playing Black Adam in an upcoming movie. And the thing about Black Adam is that if you read the comics, the difference between Black Adam and Superman, well, one of the differences, there's a lot of differences, but one of the differences is that Superman, his one weakness is magic, and Black Adam, one of his powers is magic.
This is Isaac quoting a weird video that Dwayne Johnson made about being in Black Adam. And it's weird every time.
A weird, super long Instagram live video he made trying to get people hyped up for Black Adam. He's trying to say Black Adam is cooler than Superman, but he doesn't say that.
Yeah.
And he also gets details of both characters wrong.
Ah, well. Next, we have Rachel House as Grandma Tala. I was very surprised when I found out it was her doing the grandma's voice because she is not that old. And she have mostly seen doing things with Taika Waititi in Hunt for the Wilder People. She plays the social worker. It's a very funny role. And then in Thor Ragnarok, she's Topaz, the Grandmaster's sidekick assistant. Pretty funny in that, too, even though it's not a major role.
And she's also Terry in Soul.
Yes. One of your favorite roles that she does.
My favorite role in Soul by a country mile. I've said that whenever I get back to a Disney park, I want to get like a Terry pin or something because I don't love that movie, but Terry's hilarious.
Yeah,
I think she's the MVP of this movie. It's a really impressive performance. She has to make you love the character very quickly while doing an old lady voice because she's not especially old.
And singing
in the old lady voice.
Yeah. Another person who has worked with Taika Waititi is Jemaine Clement. Frequently mistaken for Taika Waititi, and he does the voice of Tamatoa.
Taika Waititi tends to get a lot of credit for stuff that Jemaine Clement did, you know.
It's true.
For example, Taika was the director of Flight of the Conchords, but he didn't, like, write all the songs or create the series. That was him and Brett McKenzie.
That was Jemaine Clement, yes.
Taika gets credited for What We Do in the Shadows, the TV show.
Yeah, he did work on the movie with Jemaine Clement.
Yes.
But the TV show of What We Do in the Shadows is all Jemaine Clement now.
Right. And as you say, they get mistaken for each other a lot. I like Jemaine Clement. I think he's a better actor than Waititi. In the What We Do in the Shadows movie, he is one of those guys who is so funny that he can save lame jokes. Like, there's this joke I always think about. It's one of my favorite jokes in the movie. When I tell it to you on the podcast, it's going to sound awful, which is he's playing a vampire. He's saying, "Leave me alone to do my dark bidding." And somebody goes, "What dark bidding? You're sitting at the computer." And he is like, "I'm on eBay. I'm doing dark bidding on the internet."
Yeah.
You know, you're not laughing. I'm not laughing. That is a stupid Z-level pun. But for some reason, it just kills me in the actual movie. I love him. He's a ton of fun in this. Flight of the Conchords, the musical group, had a big Bowie parody song. So I feel like when they decided they wanted to have a Bowie parody song in this, basically Bowie tribute, maybe since he'd passed away, they were like, "Well, let's get we know a Maori guy who can do a Bowie impersonation, so 1 + 1 = 2
of course, I've also seen Jemaine Clement in a couple other things, like Men in Black 3, where he plays Boris the Animal.
It's just Boris.
And of course, he does the voice of Sauron in the Lego Batman movie, which I didn't know, but it, you know, you can kind of, once you know it, it's like, oh, yeah. Then we have Temuera Morrison as Tui, Moana's dad. He's mostly been doing, you know, Jango Fett and Boba Fett since they filmed Star Wars Episode 2. He does the voice of some of the clone troopers, mainly in the live action things, I think.
Yeah, the clone troopers tend to be played by Dee Bradley Baker in the animated stuff, who honestly, I think, does a better job.
Yeah, but if you want it to be exactly the clone voice, gotta have the same guy, right?
I don't like Morrison's casting in this movie. I mean, no offense to him. He's a fine actor because he's the only one who doesn't sing. Christopher Jackson has to do his singing, especially I think he sings at least as much as he talks. It's pretty close. This is one of the roles that should be the same person doing both, as we've talked about in the past.
Yeah, he's the only one who doesn't sing his own stuff. And I don't know if they just couldn't find anybody else they liked to do the father who could also sing. But, oh well.
I don't know. The singing voice sounds very different from his voice.
Yeah.
It always bothers me a little bit, but he's fine.
He does a pretty good dad voice.
Someday there will actually be a well-written Boba Fett thing that he gets to be Boba Fett in. Has it happened yet?
Nicole Scherzinger does the voice of Sina, which is Moana's mom. Most of Moana's family doesn't actually get named in the movie, but they do have names, of course. One of the funniest things about her is she played Boris's girlfriend in Men in Black 3.
Oh, interesting.
So that was funny. That's the only thing I've really seen her in. She's basically a singer. She's been in several groups, mainly one called the Pussycat Dolls. I do think it's really funny that in the post-credit scene in Ralph Breaks the Internet, where they have the little scene with baby Mo, who looks like baby Moana, playing on her tablet, the voice of Mo's mom is actually Nicole, which is funny because, of course, she's the voice of Moana's mom.
Right.
I just think it's funny that they even went as far as getting her back to do that for that silly little short scene.
Yeah, I have no takes on her performance. The two lines she has are delivered competently.
Right. Very small role. Hey, but at least she's got, you know, three parents for a while, or two parents and a grandparent, you know.
I know. It feels like too many, even though that's not many people have, you know, six parental figures or something, you know, all living grandparents and parents. But for a Disney movie, you're like, eh, do we really need all these parents? It feels ridiculous. You're going to have to kill one off. And they do.
And last but not least, we have Alan Tudyk as Hey Hey the Chicken, and also the voice of Villager Number 3, who is the villager who suggests cooking Hey Hey because he's so dumb.
I can't believe they still had to get Brownface in here. They just couldn't stop themselves at the last minute. But leaving that aside, I mean, you can't call it a performance per se, but it is hilarious that he plays Hey Hey. Hey Hey is a hilarious character. And I love that behind the scenes video you showed me where, you know, as he's leaving after a recording session of doing chicken noises, he just goes, I went to Juilliard.
So are we ready to talk about this movie?
Yes, I think it's time for us to consider the coconut.
This movie does start with vocalization over the Disney logos again. And I was wondering if that's the sort of thing they decided is their indicator of you're about to watch a musical. Because, of course, the previous movie they do that with is Frozen, which is the most, you know, they hadn't done a musical between Frozen and Moana. So I keep forgetting. I keep meaning to go pull up Encanto and see if they do some sort of singing or anything over the opening logos of Encanto too, to be like, we're indicating it's going to be a musical.
Trying to set the tone, trying to get you into a different world.
Yeah, it's good.
I will say watching all these revival movies back to back to back does them no favors because they are so formulaic and you're like, here's the intro narration again. And sure enough, it is the intro narration again.
Got to set the stage. Grandma telling stories, especially about Maui and how he stole the heart of Tafiti. And after he steals the heart, Teka appears to try to take it. And everybody wants the heart of Tafiti. And Maui loses the heart and his hook and is lost. And then Teka is spreading darkness across all the islands. And as we, you know, come into the present where we actually see her telling the stories as opposed to just the watching them happen, we see all the children. I love that Moana is sitting in the front of all the children, so entranced and happy. And all the other ones are like in shock and crying and falling over and, you know, fainting. And but she's like, yay.
Right.
Grandma, tell monster stories.
Right. And the big thing they were talking about, like in the lead up to this movie, Musker and Clements were talking about wanting this to be an action princess. That was the phrase they used over and over again.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, Moana, she loves adventure. She's not scared. She saves herself in every moment where saving is needed.
Yep. She's very brave.
And I think it does it well. I mean, I think this is a movie that without being like in a big signposted way about sexism, TM. It is a movie about sexism and the expectations of women, and it deals with it well. And that's something that the third article I linked to in our description really talks about, because, of course, many Polynesian cultures are more matriarchal than patriarchal. And it's not an unusual thing for women to be a chief or as respected as men or so on. In fact, that's actually one complaint with the portrayal of Maui, is that he usually has a like female goddess companion who he actually gets all his power from, who is of course not in this movie because we must have the Pixar duo. It's not a Pixar trio. We must follow the pattern of Toy Story, the humanity's greatest achievement.
So of course, we meet Moana's dad here and he's like, you shouldn't be telling these stories to the kids. But Moana's like, I'm excited and heading down to the ocean to have adventures. I just love baby Moana. She's so cute.
Baby Moana is very cute. This is a trick that Finding Dory pulls around this time as well.
Yeah, you have a cute baby version and everybody's like, oh, I love them already. But they originally didn't have any of the stuff with baby Moana, but as kind of a test to show the water interacting as a character, they had created this little animation of baby Moana interacting with the ocean, very similar to how it turns out, but not with her, you know, rescuing the baby turtle or anything. And everybody loved that scene so much. And whenever they showed it for people, they're like, well, where does this fit in the movie? And they were like, it doesn't. It's just a test to show that we can actually, you know, make the water a character. And everybody's like, but baby Moana. So they had to figure out a way to write her into the story. And I think they did a very good job for that scene. An Innocent Warrior, as the song is called, where the ocean gives her the heart of Tafiti.
After that, we get our first song with lyrics.
Yep. Which is Where You Are, though I tend to think of it as Moana.
I think of it as Make Way.
Yeah.
This to me, and I don't know exactly who contributed what, and I don't want to give, you know, Lin all the credit for anything because he himself has resisted that, people being like, this is the Lin-Manuel Miranda movie. And he's like, I had two collaborators, you know, but this feels the most like a Lin-Manuel Miranda song because it's so propulsive and it switches things up. It doesn't really have a traditional chorus. You know, it's constantly moving. Moana tries to change the song with, you know, I wanna see, and it's like, Moana stay, you're safe. It's very catchy. It's probably the song that gets stuck in my head most. It's very enjoyable. Yep. And it's also the song that asks us to consider the coconut.
The what?
Since we first saw it, this has been a joke between us. I love just like focusing in on a specific weird phrase in something.
Yeah.
And just making jokes about it. And I just love how he, first of all, there's something funny about consider the coconut, but there's something 1,000 times funnier about the entire island of coconut eaters and users going, the what? Because this is, you know, this is really kind of a song to explain to us, the audience, about the coconut and everything.
Right.
Not really for Moana and the chief and the islanders, but, you know, that's totally fine.
The people of Motunui. This is kind of a time passing sort of a song where we see Moana growing up, but still wanting to go to the ocean. And her dad's like, no, 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 you got to stay here. It's not till the end of the song that the song changes and slows down as the grandma manages to bring it down. But we do meet her mother in this song. So, you know, our first mom status. Moana's mother is alive and supportive through the whole movie. Pretty crazy.
Shocking. The song does actually slow down for Grandma.
Yeah, where she's singing about how she likes to dance with the water.
Mm-hmm.
And Moana seems to connect really strongly with her grandma because of this. And her grandma doesn't ever say, stay away from the water.
Right.
Oh, I think this song, isn't this where we see our director cameo? Of Musker and Clements?
Yes, it is. They're on a tapestry. I'm sure there's a proper name for it. But after this song, Moana is doing some chiefy things.
Yeah, her dad is telling her about the stones on the mountain. And
the rock sandwich.
You know, someday you'll put your stone on top and make the mountain taller.
He says, someday you'll put your rock on top. And then the distance, if you listen carefully, you hear, if you smell!
And we also basically get introduced to Moana's animal friends, Heihei the chicken and Pua the pig.
Pua is not necessary. Musgrave Clements cannot stop themselves. I have to say, you know, talking about the reasons why we made this our finale episode, it is interesting it's the last Musgrave Clements movie because they've been so important to Disney for so long.
Yeah.
And with their next movie being DC, being Warner Brothers, being their first non-Disney film together, you know, I don't know if they're going to come back. I don't know what they're going to do next. And I don't know how they're going to introduce 75 animal companions into the Metal Men movie, but they will.
It's true.
That is their defining director trait.
Oh, it's true. Even the ocean is kind of like a sidekick. Like,
oh, it
the
is.
Magic carpet.
It is 100% magic carpet 2.0. And Pooh is the one you don't need. But Heihei cracks me up.
Oh, I love Heihei so much. Even from the first time I saw it. You're like, how did they come up with the stupidest chicken? Why did they come up with the stupidest chicken? Basically, it's because they came up with a chicken and then they decided they didn't like what they were doing with it. And they're like, what if he was stupid instead?
But he's so stupid. Every time he tries to eat something that isn't food, like Heihei should not be alive. Natural selection is doing everything it can to take this chicken out.
It's so true.
We also have our candle head of the movie, which is the weird dancing kid.
Yeah.
And if you've seen the movie, you need no further elaboration.
Oh, he's so funny. And the look Moana gives him, like, okay.
But the village is dying. There's no fish.
The fish are disappearing. The coconuts are turning into, like, ash.
They look like geodes. And Moana considers the coconut, and she's like, well, if there's no fish in the reef, we should go out of the reef.
And her dad's like, no!
We'll just starve. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. This is where Moana's mom tells her the story of how her father tried to go beyond the reef one time when he was little and went with a friend of his who drowned when they were trying to go past the reef. And so that's why her father's like, no, you can't do it. It's death.
Your dad was programmed with the most tragic backstory ever.
It's very true. So then we have finally Moana's I Want song, which is How Far I'll Go. Which is also a very good song. All the songs in this movie are good.
I really have nothing to say against them. And they really make the movie work even more.
They do. They're amazing.
You know, especially coming up here. Moana tries sailing. She crashes. Her grandma intervenes. Her grandma's hilarious. She says she's the village crazy lady. She says she wants to come back as a ray. And she leads Moana to the secret boat cave. And this is one of the moments where the music really hits me, which is when, like, she touches the ship. You hear a little bit of the song that is about to happen. We Know the Way. And just that much of it, just a little piece of it, gave me chills. And I wrote that down, but then I wrote, I've had chills like four times already.
Yeah.
Again, the music is really just a cut above.
I love the song, We Know the Way. It works so well, too, in this moment where it's everything's dark and a little bit spooky. And Moana's like, what's going on? Why do we have all these huge boats? And she bangs the drum and gets this like vision of her ancestors. And the song, We Know the Way, so cool. And then, you know, she goes running out of the cave, waving her arms, going, we were voyagers. I think, like, Kermit flailing her arms.
Right. And this, of course, We Know the Way, is sung by Opetaia and Lin-Manuel. Opetaia playing a character, sort of, and Lin-Manuel just playing a disembodied voice.
He's translating for us.
I guess.
Approximately. And so we hear from, you know, she's like, Grandma, why'd we stop voyaging? And, you know, it's the spreading darkness from Taka and how all the...
Yeah, she's like, in case you missed the beginning of the movie, here it pretty much is.
Well, you know, you were very tiny and maybe you forgot the story. And this is where she gives Moana the heart of Te Fiti. And Moana's like, I thought that was just a dream that I got that from the ocean. And Grandma's like, nope.
And then having given a quest, there is no longer any need for Grandma. So we're going to need a Grandma status.
Grandma status. She is dying.
She pretty quickly is like, we need to advance the plot, disease. Oh, no. Ah!
Yeah, so she gives Moana her necklace and says, you have to go now. You have to save us. You have to go find Maui. Here's where we get the quest. You have to go find Maui. You have to say all these things to him. You have to get him to take the heart and restore it to Tafiti and save the world. And Moana's like, no, no, I don't want to go and leave you. But Grandma's like, do it. I will be with you.
And by that, I mean, I'll be dead in 2 seconds and I'll come back as a ray and I'll follow you around. It's going to be like Brother Bear, but not as stupid.
Exactly.
I didn't see Brother Bear. No one did. It's all right.
Moana goes to pack up some food and her mom sees her preparing. And I love this scene where, you know, there's no talking or anything, but Moana's mom lets her go and helps her pack and is like, I know you need to do this. Doesn't say anything, but you can tell. She's like, I know you need to do this and I'm letting you do it. And then we have the reprise of How Far I'll Go. And this is where I wrote down that I got chills, like full body chills, all of my hair standing on end. And basically the part where her grandma actually dies. And then you see the light of the manta spirit like flowing in the water. So cool. And then it's the next day and we find out that Heihei has stowed away on the boat somehow.
And Heihei has decided it's time to die.
He keeps trying to walk into the water. And finally Moana, you know, manages to get him corralled. And she's trying to steer towards the fish hook and the stars so that, because that's where Maui is, but she doesn't actually know how to sail very well. Her father has done a very good job keeping her away from the boats, and she's not quite good at it yet. Of course, you have to have a storm in any movie where somebody is on a boat on the ocean. It's probably a law.
And she shipwrecks on the island where Maui is.
Convenient, that. But I do love where she, before she realizes it's Maui's island, where she has a whole temper tantrum at the ocean. That's quite funny.
But then we get, this is not quite my favorite scene, but it's very, very close. It was probably my favorite scene the first time I watched this. I remember like dancing in my seat in the theater being like, yeah, this is so catchy, which is, of course, You're Welcome, which it's kind of shocking that the Dwayne Johnson song is, I mean, at the time I would have said the best, one of the best ones.
Yeah.
But it is, it's really good. And, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Hamilton, a lot of people, I was definitely in the theater like, all right, is there going to be like a rap part to any of the songs or a rap song? Because he's gotten famous off this rap musical. And again, the fact that it's Dwayne Johnson, it feels like him big dogging a little, but he does a good job and it's a ton of fun. And I love the, you know, colors and the abstractions as it goes along.
Yeah, the lot farther it goes, the more weird it gets. It shows that, you know, Maui has a little bit of power, even though he's lost his hook.
Feels a little Lion King in the good way.
Yeah. And at the end of the song, Maui locks her in a cave to steal her boat. And I like how Mini Maui, his little tattoo that moves around, is kind of like his conscience, a little bit like his Jiminy Cricket that he can't get rid of.
And again, the look of Mini Maui is just great. It's such a clever, cute little design.
Yeah.
And my favorite part of this, I think, is Maui attempting to eat Heihei.
Boat snack.
Boat snack, which is already funny. But then he's like, well, obviously, I got to fatten him up.
Yeah.
And then puts a giant pile of, you know, chicken feed essentially in front of Heihei, and Heihei begins attempting to eat the boat. And the reaction shot on Maui is just hilarious, where he's like, I don't even know what this is.
Moana, of course, manages to escape the cave in a very funny manner where she comes out feet first out of the like a hole in the top of the cave, and she's trying to swim for the boat. And the ocean helps her, of course, by depositing her on the boat. And then we get the really funny scene where Maui keeps trying to throw her off, but the ocean keeps bringing Moana back.
You know, I will say, like, I don't want to talk too bad on this movie because I know you love it and everything, and I love it too. There is a little bit too much sitting around on the boat talking. Feels like we could have spiced this up a little. And this is our first big scene of sitting on the boat.
Arguing.
Bickering.
Yep.
Where, of course, you know, this is all just to get us to, we're going to go get the hook. That's what's happening next. But first we got to
get Kakamora.
We got to deal with the Mad Max Fury Road. It's like 1.5% too referency for me, this scene. You know, it's the only moment really of this movie has seen other. Well, that's not true. There's a couple moments, but this is it's not that bad. It's not Ralph Breaks the Internet or anything for me. But like when the score is also Mad Max Fury Road's score, I'm like, I really get it, guys.
It's fun, though. It's our first big action sequence other than the storm, you know? Hey, like, does the only helpful thing that he does in the whole movie, I think, where he...
No, at the end, he actually does... At the end, he also eats the heart, or at least saves the heart.
Yeah, very helpfully eats the heart sometimes, I guess. I don't know, because he's a big fan of eating rocks. Very stupid chicken.
He loves to do it. This is where we get to see Maui do some cool stuff, but he's doing some cool stuff just to escape. So then Moana has to do some cool stuff to actually get the heart.
Right, because she is the one, as we said, who saves the day all the time. And she manages to fight them off, get the heart back, and then they decide to make a deal to go and get Maui's hook before they try to return the heart. And then Maui has to give Moana a wayfinding lesson.
Maui, he gets hit by a Disney butt gag.
He really does. The ocean darts him with a stun dart.
This is another, this movie's seen other movies where he's like, if you sing a song and you have an animal companion, you're a princess or whatever it is.
You're a daughter of a chief and you have an animal companion.
Mm-hmm. This is that residue of that Frozen thing where it's like, we got to comment on Disney movies and enough.
Well, I do appreciate, though, that they are pointing out some of the contrasts. Even though she is the daughter of a chief, her entire purpose is not to find a prince. In no way in this movie is she seeking for romance, or is it even mentioned as being desired or necessary? So that's kind of nice. I appreciate that.
Right.
Even with all the teasing and joking Maui does at her about being a princess, he's never like, you need to go get a guy to save you or something.
For sure. And again, Maui is, you know, a little sexist. That's not specifically his reason, but it is like, I am the big, strong demigod. I will save everything. I'm the only one who can save everything. You know, he'll eventually even be like, the ocean chose you wrong. There's no way you can be the hero. And, you know, I like that Maui, you know, they do make him kind of a jerk. Like, they make him very prickly. And even at the end, he doesn't really have to learn to stop being the kind of bro-y character he is. It's more about just him realizing that, like, Moana is the hero and I need to help her. But, you know, the way that he distracts Taka at the end is still this very bro-y way. Very funny. He's, you know, taunting her and everything. I enjoy what they do with that character. It doesn't just feel like the standard kind of Pixar duo character. You know, it's really well done. But I will have to say that on that note, you know, I think that Maui and his, you know, subtle latent sexism could do with a healthy dose of Gaster! That's right. It's time for the final installment of Gar Stuff, the show within a show where we interrogate masculinity through the lens of that most dudular of properties, the Disney animated. In this week's installment of Gar Stuff, here's a little lesson for you if you're feeling like Maui. Sometimes it's not about you. This has been Gar Stuff!
So we're headed to Lalotai, the realm of monsters, which is where Maui's hook is. It's been collected by Tamatoa, the giant crab. Lalotai is a pretty interesting looking place.
It is. It's really colorful. This is, again, I'm wondering if, like, we had one of the other directors here. Maybe Don Hall took this. But you have the beautiful neon backgrounds. Maui has to do a haka to open the realm, which is cool.
Yeah.
Always love to see a haka.
Very cool.
You know, and this is, I mean, I said that King Candy was our last cackling maniac. I guess Tamatoa sort of counts.
Yeah, he is pretty crazy.
Yeah, but he's in one scene. I mean, he's not the main villain such as it is.
Yeah, just episodic.
I do enjoy this scene a lot. I mean, come on. Like, it's Shiny, all right? Everybody loves Shiny. Everybody loves the big funny crab man. Everybody loves Jermaine Clement riffing.
It's very funny.
I mean, what's there to say? Again, it is a Bowie reference. He had recently passed away. It's a weird thing to put into this Polynesian movie, much like the Mad Max Fury Road reference, but it still basically works, still having fun. I like that this entire adventure more or less is a musical number.
Kind of, yeah.
His treasure hoard is his shell. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's also pretty violent, I mean, when he's smashing Maui against stuff.
True, but at least Maui can take it.
Although a demigod cannot beat a decapod. Look it up.
Moana, of course, has to actually rescue the hook, though, and because Maui isn't able to manage it. And when he's trying to use his hook, he is not doing a good job of transforming into what he wants. And that's pretty funny. Ends up as a half Maui with a shark head later. And then he's trying to switch back. He's Maui on top with a shark tail. But Moana tries to cheer him up, and
here's basically another bickering on a boat scene, although I think they may not be on the boat.
Well, I think they continue the bickering on the boat where Maui's like, you know, I can't do it. He's lying on the boat like,
we're dead soon.
Yeah. He reaches over to touch his hook to show, like, you know, I'm practicing, like she says to do. And he just, you know, randomly shifts between a bunch of stuff, but it's not what he wants. And so she tries to cheer him up and, you know, talk through some of their issues. And it actually does help.
His whole thing is, I'm nothing without my hook, which reminds me of a lot of superhero movies, maybe just because I happen to watch these recently. But like Iron Man 3 is all about, I'm nothing without my suit. Thor Ragnarok is all, I'm nothing without my hammer.
Yeah.
You know, it that's definitely what this reminded me of. You know, you got to figure out that you're worthwhile without your hook, or, you know, so on. To be honest, Maui's character arc is very secondary to Moana's, which is fine. The movie's named after her.
And she's named after the ocean.
And and we have the first Taka fight, which does not go well.
It does not. They do not manage to work together very well. And Maui's hook gets damaged, and he is very upset by this. You know, he's, you know, waited 1,000 years to get his hook back, finally remembered how to properly use it, and now it's cracked and broken. And he's like, this is where he basically tells Moana, you're wrong. The ocean didn't choose you. You should not be doing this quest. And he leaves. And of course, Moana is very upset, and she kind of gives up for a little bit. She gives the heart of Tafiti back to the ocean and asks it to choose someone else.
And again, you know, Maui really is pretty brutal here in his honesty. And I'm assuming this is the favorite scene of both of us, right?
The I Am Moana song?
Yes.
Yes. So her grandma comes to her in a vision, and they basically, it's, you know, start the song. It's kind of called I Am Moana and Song of the Ancestors.
Right.
But this is, I think this is the best scene where, because this is where Moana wins, you know, she basically, you know, figures out who she is, and that it's not that the ocean chose her specifically. It's that she chooses to do what the ocean needs done. The song builds and builds and builds until she sings, I am Moana, and everybody gets all the goosebumps, and she dives into the water and gets the heart back, and she is going to do it alone.
It's the best song. It's the moment where you can't help but get goosebumps and choke up.
Yep.
I mean, it's, what can you say? It's what the whole movie's about.
It is.
She is Moana. Moana, of course, being the word for ocean as well. So, you know, she's the ocean is her, she's wild, she's untamable, she's vast.
Powerful and brave. And
you're so amazing.
Exactly. So she has a plan where she's going to be able to get by Taka, and it does work. She manages to get inside the barrier mountains with, you know, a lot of danger. Big action scene again.
All the Maui contributions, he shows up like partway through, are very funny. Shark head. Chop, chop, chop.
And Maui is willingly fighting, even though his hook does in fact get destroyed, as Moana is like trying to sail her way in. And then she's like, gets to where Tafiti should be to return the heart. But where is Tafiti? It's just kind of an outline of where the island was. And Moana realizes, looks over at Taka, and sees the spiral shape on Taka's chest that was the same as the spiral shape on Tafiti's chest. And she realizes that we have a fake out villain, sort of.
Look, in isolation, and this is something that I didn't appreciate about the movie at the time, but you kind of helped me appreciate later.
Yeah.
In isolation, and this movie in and of itself, the Taka being Tafiti thing and restoring the heart that way is cool. It's a cool scene with pretty music. Parting the sea is always an amazing visual. And it's a nice moment of like, you know, so much of this movie has been about Moana and her past generations of female ancestors. And, you know, as much as she's an action hero and she has been that, she also is compassionate and she is helping out this other woman who has been, you know, hurt in such a brutal way. And it's a healing thing and it's all very nice and lovely. And you know, as a metaphor for environmentalism, which this movie is also kind of playing with, like, yes, healing the world. What a lovely way to express that. So in the movie, it works. As the 17th revival era movie in a row with a fake out villain or a villain who turns out to be not that bad, I was annoyed by it in the theater. And even now I'm like, man, I wish they'd get away from this trope. This movie and maybe Frozen can do it. None of the others and nothing else. Get rid of. We got to stop it.
It does make sense in this movie, though, because
it totally does.
Even in like a mythological way, because it's so many of the islands are volcanic based. So the heart of Tafiti is removed and she turns into basically a volcano monster, you know, and volcanoes, after they do their, you know, violent, fiery thing, what's left behind is so fertile and grows so well that, you know, the life and death aspects of it make perfect sense.
Yeah.
But I totally get what you mean, though, that it's like, but you're doing it again.
If this was the first movie that did it or the only movie that did it, you would be, I in the theater would have been like, wow, what a twist.
Yeah.
This time I was like, you know, again, okay, great. Another fake out villain. Thank you.
And then we have, you know, the scene where Tafiti is like, you know, thanking Moana and she makes a new boat for her to be able to go back home because her boat got destroyed. And, you know, Maui kind of gets a stern look, but he does get his hook replaced because Maui does need to have his hook. And Maui even receives a Moana tattoo for his adventure with her.
And what can you say? You know, we wrap things up pretty quickly in that Disney way. We're all voyaging again.
Yep, Mata Nui comes back to life.
It is funny that Moana appears to be teaching her people how to voyage while on the boats. She's teaching her parents specifically. And I was making jokes about, like, the other people on the boats being like, we can't see you. You didn't teach us how to tie knots and now we're sinking.
Ah, well.
And she has placed a shell on top of the rock sandwich, thus ensuring no one else can ever put anything on top. Thanks so much, Moana.
Or if they do put something on top of the shell, it will crush the shell.
Yes.
But yeah, they're voyaging and looking for new lands. And now voyaging is okay again. And we actually get the title again at the end of the movie, which... it's weird. I never am sure why they choose to do that sometimes.
because the Lion King did it.
But why did they choose to do it in the Lion King?
I don't know.
I guess it's like, hey, don't forget what movie you were watching. We only said Moana's name 50,000 times.
She even said, I am Moana, in case you forgot. I think the reason they do it in Lion King is because it's like the cycle begins anew.
That makes sense. Circle of life.
I don't know why they do it in Moana. It's just to remind you that you're watching Moana. You've been watching Moana on Disney Channel. There is a post-credit scene.
Yeah, and some really crappy credits covers.
Oh, don't yes, even thank listen you. To them.
Blech, blech. I mean, not thank you. I mean,
thank you for reminding me that we need to talk about how bad they is. The How Far I'll Go, Alicia Cara version, I think. Is that how we're saying her name? Who I'm told is a great singer. Dad apparently enjoys her music a lot. And I totally believe that, listen, there are artists who I've loved who have turned in crappy credits covers, so.
It's true.
Not blaming her, but this one's garbage. Dump it.
Yep. Then there's another version of You're Welcome featuring, I forget who, actually.
Jordan Fisher. Yeah, it's not good.
It is not.
Although Jordan Fisher would go on to do the fake pop songs for Turning Red.
That's funny.
There is a post-credit scene, as several of the movies recently have had.
Featuring Tamatoa and a joke about The Little Mermaid, which was the first Musker and Clements. Well, no, I lied. Was the first big hit that Musker and Clements did, where he jokes that, you know, if he was a Jamaican crab named Sebastian, you'd like him better.
Yep. Tamatoa has also seen other movies. It's cute enough.
It is. It's fun.
We forgot to mention that, you know, when he's on his back initially, he's like, did you like my song? It's funny.
Yeah.
it's funny. We all like Tamatoa, folks.
We do.
So now it's time for sequels, spinoffs, remakes, rides, and reboots.
Not much.
There will be one, but there isn't yet.
Yep. They have announced a Disney Plus TV series set to premiere in 2024. That's a ways out still. But there is some stuff in the parks, a little bit. There is some meet and greets with Moana, of course. Yeah, she is a Disney princess, and much as she protests. And rarely you can see Maui also, but mostly it's just Moana.
Are they both just people in costumes, or are we doing cartoon heads? What I'm seeing is that Moana is just in a costume, but Maui has a cartoon head.
Oh, there you go. You found a good one. Yes, I had seen, you know, Moana being a person in a costume, but I couldn't find a good picture of Maui. So there you go. You found him. Yes, he's like full body costume.
It should be noted that the Maui full body costume is also doing the people's eyebrow.
Of course it is.
The famous Dwayne. I mean, I don't even know why the people's eyebrow is a thing. It's just Dwayne The Rock Johnson raising his right eyebrow, but. Nevertheless,
and it's from when he was a wrestler.
No, I know.
It was a thing he did, and they called it the people's eyebrow. And
he raised his eyebrow. It didn't deserve to be a thing, is what I'm saying. You got to get a better gimmick. The Undertaker's out here, like, climbing out of a coffin and claiming to be actually literally undead. And you're like, I'm raising my eyebrow. We can do better.
They have announced an attraction to be at Epcot called Journey of Water, which will be an interactive water garden that's Moana themed.
Where's that going to be? Is there like a Polynesian land or anything even remotely?
I don't know that there is a specific place. Again, it's announced and they have maybe started working on it, but it's not done. It's going to be like a water maze. So they actually are kind of rebranding some stuff of Epcot. So rather than just having the World Showcase and Future World, as it used to be, what used to be Future World, that whole front section is going to be divided kind of into Discovery, World Celebration, and World Nature. So I'm suspecting it's going to be in the World Nature area.
Great. So a Moana TV series seems like kind of a bad idea.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what they're going to do with it, right? What is it going to be? Just like a adventure journey of the week? Like we land on an island, adventures happen. At the end of the episode, we move on to a new one?
I guess. But it seems like most of the frankly, it seems like all of the conflicts in Moana's life have been pretty much resolved. So, yeah, I guess it would just have to be like running into more monsters like Tamatoa and the Kakamora, like, oh no, now it's this.
I mean, I presume she's going to run into some of them again, though why you'd run into the Kakamora when they were trying to get the heart and she doesn't have it anymore, I don't know.
Yeah, I think episodic would be the only way to do it. If it becomes a, you know, epic series length story like Tangled, it's going to be probably bad.
Yeah. At least with Tangled, you can see why there would still be conflict in her life.
On the other hand, what if, like, the Hercules and Emperor's New Groove shows, it ends up being inexplicably set at a high school?
Yeah, no, let's hope not. We do not need Moana's School of Wayfinding.
That's exactly what it would be called, too. Well, shockingly, that's it.
It's true. As with such a popular movie, you'd think they'd have, you know, more stuff already, but I guess not.
I wonder if it's a little bit of that, you know, if it's the Tiana thing where it's like, wow, it's weird that this really popular character who isn't white hasn't gotten a tenth of the things that all the other princesses have.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it's because they're more concerned about making something offensive again, as they frequently do when they just throw something out real quick, you know?
Sure, sure. Very possible. But Mom, I gotta ask you something.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you recommend this movie, and would you show it to a child?
Yes, 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 yes. I really love this movie. I think this is probably one of my favorite movies of the entire Disney canon. Sleeping Beauty is still my all-time favorite, but I kind of think of, you know, that's my favorite of all of them, but my favorite of the newer ones is probably Moana. And by newer, I mean since the Renaissance era.
Right.
Obviously, I have liked a lot of those movies, but Moana is just the best. Makes me happy every time I watch it.
I wouldn't personally go that far in my own enjoyment of it, but I do really like it. It's an easy recommend. You could definitely show it to a child. There's nothing that scary. I do basically still see this as one of the princess movies, but it's a really good princess movie.
And a different one.
And a different one, yeah. I don't think I mentioned that I actually, when I was teaching, co-teaching at college, a female action heroes class, we talked about this movie and the idea of the action princess. You know, there's not a lot of Disney movies you're going to talk about in a feminist theory class as anything other than, oof, look at this. Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, the only other princess I can really think of as even being any sort of action hero is Merida in Brave.
Yeah.
And even she has to deal with, you know, people trying to hook her up with some guys.
Tangled a little bit, but only a little bit. You know, she's doing some stuff with the hair. She does save herself, but, you know, it's not really action-y, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is where normally we'd talk about what we think of the revival era. And so I suppose we should do that. But we also have an opportunity to reflect on doing this podcast and the whole darn enchilada. As far as the revival era itself, I feel like with these movies, they either ended up near the top of my animated canon rankings or near the bottom.
Meaning Winnie the Pooh is near the bottom.
Winnie the Pooh's near the bottom. Honestly, Zootopia, you know, is somewhat near the bottom as well. Certainly not at, I guess. But it's like, these movies either are super, super formulaic. Some of them are absolutely great.
Yeah.
Some of them can't escape the formula for me. You know, I do think that's kind of the thing about the revival era. It's when Disney was becoming very, very crystallized.
Yep.
And everything starts to feel the same. All the Pixar stuff and the Disney stuff, animated stuff, start to feel the same. Obviously, we have the Star Wars things and the Marvel things and almost no other live action work, because it's in the revival era that they take some big chances on some big weird live action movies like Tomorrowland and John Carter. And those end up bombing really bad. I think Moana is really good, but after this, they really start to feel kind of calcified and stale for the most part. But again, some of the movies in here are just great. And like, you still can't deny that it's better than the experimental era. That's my feeling.
Oh, for sure. I think it's definitely still one of the better eras. I really enjoy almost all of these movies. Not quite all. Looking at you, Winnie the Pooh.
So I have been making from the beginning, this is on my Letterboxd for anyone who follows me there, a ranking of all of the movies we've covered on this show. And I thought it might be fun to go through all of them now, my ranking personally from best to worst, with which I think will be pretty close to yours. Don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but to, you know, kind of reflect back on the entire thing.
Yeah.
So number one, to the surprise of no one, Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah.
Number one of the actual canon, Sleeping Beauty, which was a little surprising to me.
Yeah.
I knew that I loved Sleeping Beauty. And when we watched it, I was like, you know, this is the first perfect movie we've covered.
Uh-huh.
Honestly, nothing else as we've been watching stuff hits me like that movie does. It has the like perfect mix of music, amazing animation that doesn't look like anything else. A really enjoyable, if fairly abstract, plot and characters. It's funny. It just has everything. It's great. The dragon fight is still, I think, one of the best action scenes of the whole canon.
Uh-huh.
Amazing stuff. And of course, an all-timer cackling maniac.
Indeed.
Some of the other movies that I really loved, The Lion King, Wreck-It Ralph, Lilo and Stitch, Tangled, Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, Mulan, Beauty and the Beast. Also in the very good zone, Great Mouse Detective, Fantasia, Dumbo, which that's another one where I'm like, I'm kind of surprised it's my favorite of the golden era. I guess Fantasia actually was. Never mind. Another one that I'm surprised how highly it placed. I still think it's one of the best Disney movies about discrimination, as much as they keep returning to that well. Robin Hood, one of my favorite podcast episodes as well.
Yep.
Alice in Wonderland, which was a great revisit for both of us.
Yeah, that one was, I feel like, the surprise hit.
The Jungle Book, Emperor's New Groove, Sword in the Stone, Treasure Planet. I know. I know. Especially because I put it above Aladdin as the next
one. Wow.
But I think, is that my highest rated Musker and Clements? No, Great Mouse Detective is, of course. Radigan cannot be beat.
Yep.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. A goofy movie, another surprising revisit for us. Moana, which should not be taken as I don't like Moana, but I like all of these movies so much. 101 Dalmatians, Little Mermaid. Now we're kind of starting to get into the hit and miss ones for me. Things that have great stuff in them, but don't wholly come together. Cinderella, Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Bambi, Rescuers Down Under, Big Hero 6, Lady and the Tramp, Make Mine Music, Saludos Amigos, Fantasia 2000, Meet the Robinsons, Princess and the Frog, Atlantis : The Lost Empire, Pinocchio, Three Caballeros, Hercules, Frozen, Zootopia. Fun and Fancy Free, which is exactly half good.
Yep.
The Aristocats, which has one of my favorite scenes in Disney and a bunch of scenes I don't really enjoy at all. Peter Pan, Black Cauldron, The Rescuers. Now we get into the just bad ones. Winnie the Pooh, 2011. Just no thank you.
Yep.
The impossible to accurately rate or place Dinosaur. The one so bad it's good movie.
It's true. There really aren't very many of those in the Disney animated canon.
A horrendous, borderline unwatchable movie I have gleefully recommended to many people. Bolt, Oliver and Company, Tarzan, Melody Time. And now for the real, real bad, starting with Melody Time. Home on the Range, Pocahontas, Chicken Little, Brother Bear, and of course, The Fox and the Hound.
Yeah, nobody beat it. None of the movies were as bad as that one.
Nothing else made us feel like we were physically experiencing brain death quite like Fox and the Hound. The worst vibes of any Disney movie. So as you look back on all those movies, Mom, on this podcast, what have you learned? And what do you hope that our audience will take away with them?
It was very interesting watching them all in order and, you know, so close together most of the time to see the patterns, to see the formulas that they followed in some of the movies that I never really thought about before on some of them as things went on. But what I kind of take from it is even when, you know, they're in a slump and they're just doing bad movie after bad movie, it feels like, you know, wait a while, it'll come back around and they'll do good movies again. Mm-hmm. And then it'll get bad and they'll do bad movies again. You know, it's very cyclical. Time passes, things change.
It is very cyclical. It is interesting how you can basically split it into, with a few outliers in every case, you know, good movies, bad movies, good movies, bad movies, good movies, bad movies, good movies. And I think we're kind of in some bad movie zone right now, where it's certainly less good.
I mean, it's annoying that they did several sequels in some ways. I mean, I didn't hate them. Ralph Breaks the Internet, we talked about, not so good. Frozen 2, great songs, but story-wise, not so good. But I like Raya, and I like Encanto, and we'll see what we see about Strange World. Disney hasn't yet gotten bad enough that I feel like I am not going to even bother going to see any of these in theater. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely not. No.
We definitely got in that phase during the experimental era where it was just like, why would I go see a Disney movie? They're never good.
I mean, are we going to do that again? Because I feel like now I just want to always have watched all the animated canon, even though I assume they're going to be Drek for a while at some point.
I don't know. We'll see. But it's true, you know, now you feel like I must have them all. I've gone through the process of having watched all the ones I'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I never have to watch Fox and the Hound again.
That's right. I can't imagine a circumstance where that would be the case. There is something so fun about seeing all of them and finding the kind of surprise great ones. All my favorite episodes, or most of my favorite episodes, are I loved covering the movies that were forgotten, talked about less.
Yeah.
Whether good or bad, honestly. Like Meet the Robinsons was like, wow, this is actually quite good. Oliver and Company is like, wow, this is really one of the worst, in my opinion. Going through all the wartime era shorts and seeing all of that stuff. I definitely think about animation differently. You know, I pay more attention to...
It's true. I do notice things I didn't notice before.
Exactly. Styles of animation and directors. Before doing this podcast, I probably knew Brad Bird. I probably knew Musker and Clements. And as far as like Western animation directors, that's probably all I knew. I do think Disney's probably at a crossroads. I mean, I feel like this year, maybe I'm just trying to make it a big deal because it's the year we're ending this podcast, but like, there hasn't been a Disney movie yet this year, an animated canon film. But the Pixar movies have been Turning Red, which is, you know, it's the first Pixar film from a female director and the first one from a non-white director. It is a very specific movie. It has a really interesting animation style. It's dealing with some themes that are unusual for a Disney film. It's more modern. It feels very fresh. You know, you and I, neither of us, I think, loved that movie in the way a lot of people did, but definitely a fresh, exciting, good movie. And on the other hand, they had Lightyear, which is just, you know, the most routine, formulaic, corporate waste of time imaginable. That was, of course, also a big critical and commercial failure. In fact, in general, Disney has been doing, it's hard to say they haven't been doing well this year, but a lot of the movies that have come out this year have had like two, and even last year, I've had like 2 good weeks in theaters where they still basically make their money back from the hardcore fans, and then they kind of die off. You know, a lot of it's starting to feel a bit stale, and I feel like Disney, you know, talking about the eras, it's like you have a choice, as you so often do. You can either like try to go full commerce, you can make more stuff like Lightyear that's just trying to milk the same handful of, you know, dead horses, or you can decide to be something better and new and more interesting and give people more creative control to make stuff like Turning Red.
Yep.
Find great directors with interesting ideas like Domi Shi. And
true. I definitely like it when they take some chances, even if they don't always come out great.
Yeah, I mean, my favorites are the ones that are very different in some way or another. Like, even leaving aside Brave Little Toaster, like Sleeping Beauty, a kind of animation they never did again. The Lion King, so much darker. Wreck-It Ralph, you know, very different in feel. Lilo and Stitch, one of the weirdest movies they've ever made, you know.
It's true.
I think that basically having a Disney formula or a Pixar formula is mostly a bad thing. I would honestly rather see them try weird stuff that's hit and miss, because I think the hits will be much more, much better. And if there's anything like that people take away from this podcast, I think what I'm proudest of with it is, like, so much of the Disney discourse online is basically like Disney is pure evil or Disney is pure good. You know, so many of the other Disney podcasts you listen to are just going to be completely apologetic for every single thing Disney does and has ever done. And I think that's not productive. I think clearly we love a lot of these movies and they mean so much to us.
Yeah.
It is hard to have more of a familial connection to Disney than we do. Like, again, I think that's been one of my favorite things as we watch all these in order is revisiting, you know, what they meant to your mother, what they meant to you, what they mean to me, what they mean to Isaiah and Dad and Bailey and all the wonderful guests that we've had.
Yep. Yep.
Talking to other people who listen to the podcast about what it means to them.
It's been fun.
And yet, at the same time, I think Disney as a corporation probably shouldn't exist. I think that it has been a net bad for society. And even if you're not willing to go that far, like, so many of the people who've run it have been monsters who have facilitated so much bad stuff happening in the studio and outside of it. And you don't have to dwell on that stuff or let it ruin the movies for you, but you shouldn't just ignore that either. And like that, that is the more productive direction I'd like to see Disney fandom move into is, yes, we love these movies. They mean a lot to us. We love the creatives who actually made them. But we can also be, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, all these studios have come out about how horribly Disney treats its, you know, CGI animators. Just these horror stories. You can look up the articles. They're really, really quite bad. And it's like, we can enjoy these movies and also say they should not be made on a bedrock of human misery. Like,
very true.
We shouldn't be having these aggressive release schedules that just destroy people's lives.
Yep.
People can be treated well and make great movies.
It's true. One of the other things that doing this podcast has done for me is that even on the movies I didn't like or that I didn't like very well, I frequently found something to appreciate in them. Like whether it was something like they were really trying something different with this, either with the story or with the animation or even just appreciating the hard work that went into it, even if it turned out to be garbage.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Like I can appreciate the work behind the movie that went into it, and doing the research on these movies would sometimes actually make me like the movie more than I'd liked it when I was watching it. Do you know what I mean? Just because if you feel like you start to appreciate the effort that went into it, it actually makes you like the finished product a little more sometimes.
Sure. Even Fox and the Hound, like it's cool to see Glenn Keane doing some of his first major animation with the bear scene.
Yeah.
And really realize, like, compared to everything else in that movie, like,
so different.
It's such an illustration of Keane as a talent. Like, it is one of the best showcases for him because it's like, you see it, all the rest of this versus this part.
What I did?
You can definitely tell which was done by a master and which was done by, you know, basically scabs. Who didn't even finish coloring in the characters sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But mostly, Mom, I've enjoyed doing this with you. I feel like one of the main reasons we did this was because we were going COVID crazy. I mean, we talked about doing it for years, but that's what eventually settled it is like, we'd like to you know, do something together, anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what it's about. Forget the mouse. That's not the important part of the title.
It's family.
It's about family. Hello, it's Vin Diesel. I was mentioned earlier. I also do, you know, want to give a special shout out to. No, I genuinely do want to talk a little bit about Brad Murray. I mean, our episodes, once he came on, sounded so much better. And it was challenging to find an editor because I didn't just want someone who would make the audio sound better or, you know, take away the work of editing this ourselves, which was like, if we'd had to keep doing that, the podcast would have ended in the silver era. It was exhausting.
Indeed.
And, you know, just on a technical level, his work is great. If you ever heard the raw audio of this, heard, you know, the chairs squeaking and the burps and the sneezes and the drinking from water bottles and the let me look this up.
Yep.
And the technical difficulties.
And the constant sniffing.
No kidding.
There's some serious allergies going on between us. That's all I, you know.
So that alone is amazing, but we were really looking for someone who could be an editorial partner. We were like, we are just going to give this audio to you and put our trust in you to make a great episode. And there have been so many episodes where we've recorded it and I've been like, that felt like such a meandering conversation.
Or low energy.
That was low energy. Is that going to turn out to be anything at all? And we get the audio back from Brad and it's like magic. It's a really good episode. Really tight. He really finds the focused like element of it and builds it around that. It really is like he is as much an author of this show as you or I am, I feel. And he delayed his retirement from podcast editing to help us get out our final episodes. And then we gave him so many extra statuses to do and so many extra editing jokes and so many technical difficulties and the fireworks on Wreck-It Ralph. So really, thank you so much, Brad.
Yes, we really appreciate you.
We absolutely could not have made this podcast without you. And it's amazing. And we'll be sure to retweet whatever you're doing next. Share it far and wide. Support Brad, everybody. Go do that. And I suppose that's it. I almost don't want to end the episode because then it's done forever. I'll never have to stay up all night setting up this recording equipment. And we'll never have to deal with resyncing episodes after technical difficulties. And I'll get most of my evenings back because I won't be watching the worst spinoffs and television programs on Disney Plus. And wait, am I going to miss this at all?
It'll be nice to have a break, but I'm sure you'll come up with something fun to do later.
I'm sure I'll be continuing to do something insane. I can't stop. I won't stop. But this is the end. So for the final time, I'm me.
And I'm Mom.
And it all started with a mouse.